Today I'm talking with Stephen Lewis, and Stephen is the president of the Forum for Theological Exploration, and he, with two of his colleagues, Matthew Williams and Dory Baker, have co-authored a book called The Care Effect, Enact Your Most Faithful Next Step, which will be published by Chalice, hopefully, in November of 2019. I know that the FTE is a very innovative organization, and they've thought a lot about this whole idea of creativity and innovation and trying and doing new things. So let's just start by, Stephen, could you just tell us a story about a congregation or a community of faith that's really innovative?
The person I want to mention is Reverend Dr. Heber Brown III, and he's the pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore, Maryland. So here was a problem that he was addressing. In 2010, he was visiting members in his congregation in the hospital, and where they were being treated for kind of diet-related health problems. And one of the things he talked about is that, you know, seminary had trained him to give scripture and prayer for people in the hospital, but he wanted to do more. And so he really longed for a way to address kind of the physical health needs of his congregation. And he began kind of a listening tour around his community and noticed that there was a food desert, which is to say the lack of nutritious, affordable food at convenient places within his neighborhood. The challenge was really to create kind of alternative food deserts or alternatives to the food deserts that were impacting his community. And he came up with the Black Church Food Network, Food Security Network. It's the Black Church Food Security Network. So what I want to do is just show you just briefly, this video that we created as part of our Changemaker Risk Taker series to give you some context for this. So anyway, that's a story that I would tell about a congregation who is working innovatively to address challenges that impact his members and the surrounding neighborhood, which I think speaks to the Matthew 25 passage, which is, you know, I was hungry and you fed me and those kind of ideas. So I think that's just one kind of small concrete way of a congregation is engaged in innovation.
Well, tell us what like initially drew the FTE to focus on looking at innovation and congregations, and tell us about some of the things that you're doing.
We work primarily with young adults who are exploring vocation and Christian ministry in particular. Another way that we talk about it, you know, young adults who are exploring vocations in Christian ministry. But what we've noticed over the last several years is that young adults who are motivated by their faith want to make a difference in their communities, but they don't necessarily see their parents or their elders' institutions as places to do that. Or we find congregational leaders who are accompanying young adults or young leaders, pastors of congregations who are really trying to lead change and be responsive to the kind of numerous issues that come up in their congregational context, but they don't necessarily know how to do this. So we know that part of this is about exposure. Part of this is about vocational imagination, seeing yourself and seeing what's possible in the vocation, and that ministry might be a way in which you could do this. And some of this is about opportunity and agency. Mm-hmm. So we work with a number of different institutional leaders who are researchers, PhDs, researchers, who then they become kind of the pathway into executive leadership in theological education. And as we've been working with them, what we recognize is that the vast majority of them are providing programmatic solutions to institutional challenges. And what it speaks to is that there's nothing in their educational formation typically that prepares them to think about the stuff of organizations. And so it's a reinforcing loop of having researchers that lead institutions that are already strained and tenuous, and they're trying to figure out like what, you know, how do I, you know, what am I supposed to do? So a lot of their learning is on the job and quickly as they're kind of drinking out of fire hose trying to engage in this new profession. But we say to them, when you've moved from being a professor in a classroom, a researcher, to run an institution, you've entered into a whole nother profession. And the real question is, what are the kind of technical systems and resources that you can have around you that will support you and build your capacity for this new role that you're in? So I say all that to say is that, you know, that some of this is also about capacity building. The final thing that I would say why we got involved in this is that as we begin working with these leaders, we also begin to understand that we need to codify how people, at least Christian leaders, actually engage in innovation. So some of the things that we're doing, we're working with institutional doctoral networks that are comprised of leaders of doctoral institutions that are trying to address this one single question, which is how we create the conditions for scholars and students of color to thrive, which is really a larger question about how do we change culture and how do we also lead change in our institutional context to create spaces where everyone can do their best work, but including this kind of increasing diversity within our institutional context can find a place where they can actually do their best work as well. We're also doing work through a kind of an 8-week innovative kind of social entrepreneurship accelerator for people working at the intersection of faith and social entrepreneurship, which is called Do Good X. And Do Good X is basically, you know, an 8-week accelerator that allows young Christian leaders or those who are not so young to create new solutions, new institutional solutions to address the concerns within a larger community as a way of doing good in the world and being an embodiment of what it means to be, or at least participate in God's work in the world. And then thirdly, what I would say, the way in which we're engaging in innovation is we've been doing a series of consultations over the last 18 months, 5 different cities, trying to understand how different Christian leaders, pastors, scholars, and other leaders of church-related organization understand innovation. And of course, there are regional differences in that regards. And then finally, what I would say is that we're trying to build relationships with innovative Christian leaders to put them in front of young people to expand, catalyze their imagination about what's possible. And so much of what we see in church are kind of the sleepy, you know, traditional ways of what people do on Sunday morning. And you and I both know that religious communities are much more diverse and multidimensional than what we see on Sunday. And so we're trying to help them see, at least expand their imagination of what ministry can look like, and that it is an actual place that actually could really make meaningful change or contribution to the communities in which they're embedded in.
Do you think there are particular ways in which, particular issues that churches have found it easier to take an innovative approach around? Or another way to ask that too, are there particular barriers standing in the way of churches working in an innovative way or kind of embracing innovation?
And I don't think it's just particular to church. I think it's particular to human nature, which is, you know, we typically are reluctant to any change that happens to us. And we like to be engaged in change when we're ready to be engaged in it. And the vast majority of us don't like change. So when people see innovation, I think they also hear that as proxy for change. And proxy for change can also sometimes mean, you know, it is a veto or is a judgment on them and what has worked for them versus it being something about how can we make it even better or how can we make it more inclusive or how can we value what has been done and at the same time value the ways in which we might need to adapt, to respond, to be nimble for what is to come. And I think that's some of what you see in what Greg Jones is trying to hold up with kind of tradition innovation, though I would say, you know, from my point of view, I think of it more of kind of like it is this type of African kind of saying and idea, which is Sankofa. How do we look back and bring the best of our past forward into the future so it can be beneficial to the present? I think Greg is trying to say something similar when he's talking about tradition innovation, which is innovation is being drawn upon, you know, the traditions of our past. And I would say sometimes, but sometimes it breaks tradition. That's why I think tradition innovation, it can fall apart if you're really trying to be innovative. I think in the end, sometimes innovation is about breaking from the past.
It's the wisdom or the discernment it takes to know when is it time to bring something forward from the past or to retrieve and to remake that? And when is it time to just say, it's over. We can't continue in that way anymore.
Yeah, in many ways, you know, innovation is discernment. I mean, it is a process of discernment. We don't come through a discernment process and do nothing, at least hopefully. Hopefully discernment leads towards us doing something radically different or evolutionarily different than what we currently are in our current state of things. And that's, in many ways, that's what call is, right? I mean, call is a calling to do something maybe different than what you are. It's not necessarily a departure. Sometimes it's building upon, you know, something of the past, but sometimes it is a departure. But there's a whole process about how do you do that? And I think innovation is a kind of discernment process towards that end. So innovation could be used as a way of, as the congregation thinks about discernment on a number of different issues as it relates to their work. New ministries, how do we sunset existing ministries? How do we think about calling forth the next generation of leaders, to thinking about whether or not we should build into a new kind of capital campaign, or should we keep our church small and find other ways in which we can leverage those resources than just build a building? Or how do we move from being just simply a come and see organization to a go and make kind of disciple organization in the broader community? You could use an innovative process to do all those kinds of things. So I don't think there's any one particular thing that it can be useful for or not. I think the broader question is, what is innovation? And how do people understand innovation?
Do you use that language with congregations, or do you just use the word discernment? I mean, do you think that the language of innovation is helpful in our context, or do you not want to use it so much?
I think it depends on the audience. And you try to use kind of the lingua franca of the group or whatever. So, I mean, I think it really is about how people respond. And sometimes we need to break out of the categories that we're accustomed to in order to see from a different perspective or something new. Younger people tend to be open to it, but, you know, it's such a used phrase. It's such a increasingly, like, in the broader kind of sphere beyond religious institution, I mean, it is a buzzword. And in our field, it is becoming even more of a catch-all kind of buzzword phrase. Uh-huh. So, you know, I think, you know, it really does depend on the audience.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, tell us about your forthcoming book, The Care Effect. You know, what's the focus? Who'd you guys write this book for? Tell us a little bit about that. Do you use the word innovation?
Yeah, we do. You know, and maybe before we end, you know, I'll just say a little bit about what we mean when we talk about innovation.
Yeah, definitely. Go right ahead. Yeah.
So I think part of what I'm wrestling with is this idea that innovation, I'm kind of drawing on kind of two different camps. So there's one out of Harvard that comes out of the kind of Christian Claytonson group. And then there's another one that kind of comes out of kind of, it's a Kellogg professor who's kind of, you know, thinking about innovation or whatever. But one of the things I would say is that innovation can be thought of as a noun, and innovation could also be thought of as a verb or some type of activity. As a noun, what I would say is that, you know, innovation, broadly speaking, is simply something different that has impact. And I think innovation as a verb is a process of creating value by applying a novel solution to meaningful problem. So it is a process that leverages novel solutions to find a solution to a problem. Or as a noun, it's just something different that has impact. Now, one of the things that I would say also too is that for me, and the way that we've been talking in our shop, is that there is a typology when it comes to innovation. In other words, I want to suggest that there are at least four different types of ways for talking about innovation beyond simply as a noun or a verb. So there's innovation that non-religious people do. There is innovation that Christian leaders do. Then there is non-religious people who are engaged in what I would call Christian innovation. And there are Christians who are working at trying to do Christian innovation. The vast majority of at least the conversations I've been in are about Christians doing innovation. And that is not the same as Christian innovation. And I think the distinction for me is that Christian innovation is ultimately something different that has gospel impact. In other words, Christian innovation has a particular telos. It has a particular end. And the end, I think, is about the gospel. Now, of course, there are many different ways to interpret that, what the good news is, but I think that is the telos to Christian innovation as a noun. As a verb, I think Christian innovation similarly is a process for creating value by applying novel solutions to meaningful problems that result in gospel impact. So what then is gospel impact? From where I sit, I would say that gospel impact is what Jesus speaks about in Luke 4:18 and 19, where he talks about the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. That people in communities who become his disciples or fall in his way are called to engage in the same Spirit who seeks to be upon them for the sake of God's goodness, which is about human flourishing. That's John 10:10, you know, the whole idea about abundant life for all people. It's also about the well-being of all community. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Or it's about the healing of all nations in the world, which is Revelation 22. So the way in which I think about the gospel impact, I think I'm trying to tie that back to this young adult, person of color, a lower socioeconomic status, born to a teenage mother who's an immigrant, who is the founder of our faith, who always finds himself at odds with the religious authorities and moving in between religious communities and the broader community, trying to be an embodiment of the God who has emptied God's self into him. And what he says, I use that 4:18 and then, you know, use those other iterations of it. So Christian innovation as a verb, I think, is all ultimately in service to the ends of the gospel impact. So we can talk about Christians doing innovation. I'm not sure Christians doing innovation is distinctively different from non-Christians doing innovation. But I think Christians who engage in Christian innovations is working towards a particular telos, a particular end.
Okay, can we apply your typology to the story that you told us at the beginning about the pastor who saw the health problems and built gardens?
Right.
So are you saying that he could have seen these health problems and said, okay, we need just to have healthier people. We live in a food desert.
Yeah.
We could grow our own food, or we could build a better health clinic here, or we could get a different grocery store. He could have come up with a variety of different innovative solutions to that problem.
And he didn't need to be a pastor to do it.
And he didn't need to be a pastor to do that. Okay, but my guess is that he wanted to have gospel impact.
Yes.
Okay, so he sees another language here I think would be, he sees the mission of the church to address this food desert, to improve the health of people, but for a larger purpose, in relationship to a larger purpose.
A larger community. That's a reflection of, you know, the Matthew 25 passage.
Right. So he might use lots of different kinds of language in his tradition that would capture that the ultimacy of what this innovative work is about.
Right. And the motivation, I mean, at the end of the day, is about the motivation. The motivation is different, I think, behind Christian innovation versus a Christian who's doing innovation. Because there are a lot of Christians who are doing innovative things to make money. And that is the telos, which is to make a living, to support a lifestyle. And that's not any different from a non-religious person or somebody of a different faith.
Then your argument about Christian innovation is that the end, the larger ultimate purpose and motivation, really is a shaping force. And the discernment, just to go back to your piece about if it's really a verb and I really have to discern what's to be done here, your ultimate vision, whatever religious language you put around that, the ultimate gospel impact that you define really shapes that discernment.
Right. I mean, I think it's about a new heaven and a new earth. Or it's a transformed world. Christian innovation should be in service to that. Let me show you another thing that I've created as a way of kind of speaking to that. In my mind, part of the question is like, what is the purpose of Christian innovation? And I think how it's distinctive from other things is that there's this idea of purpose, serendipity, calling. There's this kind of numinous awe that I think faith becomes a catalyzing effect for innovation. But ultimately, it's in service to a transformed world, which is about an alternative to the status quo or empire, as we see in first century Christianity. It is in service to the well-being of all. It's about human flourishing. But it's also about, you know, God's preferential kind of treatment and beginning point which is the least among us. So anyway, you know, I would say that this right here, you know, in my mind is the purpose of Christian innovation. And I would go on to say is that, you know, when we think about this, part of what I'm trying to get at is this idea that when I think about Christian innovation, I'm also talking about some assumptions. And one of the assumptions behind Christian innovation is that it does have some attention to the margins within our community, that the starting place is not our center or about our starting point, but is where God has already been operating and we're trying to catch up to. It is about a better world. I think there is some inventiveness in what's happening, and it's an iterative history. It is not ahistorical. I think there are imposters to innovation or Christian innovation. Like, change is an imposter. Just because you do something different doesn't mean that it's necessarily innovative. Just because something is cool does not mean that it is Christian innovation. Just because something is good does not mean it's Christian innovation. Just because something is creative is not necessary that is Christian.
It's not synonymous, you're saying. They're not synonymous.
Now, Christian innovation, I think, does bring about change. I think it can be creative. I think it can be cool and it can be good, but those things are not proxy for Christian innovation. And then, you know, I think there are different types. So you see this in the larger literature where, you know, you have, you know, breakthrough, you know, you can talk about innovation in terms of a breakthrough, a new market. It can be disruptive or it can be sustaining. And I think in our context, in the religious context, you can leverage Christian innovation because I think ultimately at the end, it is about communities. And so it's necessarily social. But it is about services. It could be about a process or process improvement. It could be Christian innovation could be about an experience. How do you create a different kind of experience? Or it can be about our ritual life, whether that's worship or some other ritual that we use in service to the kind of different markers within, you know, the different stages of life. And then, you know, I'll just say that finally that part of what we've been working on is an approach to Christian innovation, which is moving people from this idea that in the end is about inventing alternatives to the powers that be so that we can create a transformed world of a new heaven and new earth. But it's all grounded in our values and our motivation, which calls us to get curious about our context and the people that we want to work with and the holy other in which God operates in. It's about making meaning of our experiences as a result of our curiosity. Is being open to imagine and ideating new ideas, then it's about experimenting, try something, do something. Like Pentecost came and folks are like, okay, we got to do something new. We no longer have to go to the Jerusalem temple. And then you see Peter and the disciples in Acts 1 through 10 experimenting, trying something. And then you see this idea of like validating and proving, like, I don't know if I can go to the Gentiles because it's unclean. And then you see like, stuff happening as, you know, God comes to them in dreams and you see other ways in which it's proven and then you go and do it. In that assumes then, you know, that there are different mindsets, different kind of methods about how you go about doing that. So we've been kind of thinking about this for some time and thinking about kind of the theological underpinnings behind Christian innovation. So I'll stop there, but, you know, I just wanted to kind of get that into our conversation because I want to push the conversation beyond just simply Christians engaging innovation. But Christians have something particular to say and are doing something specifically when they are deploying this idea of innovation, which makes it Christian. Because the question becomes, what makes innovation distinctively Christian? Or to say another way, what is particularly distinctive about Christian innovation? And I think these are some of the things, though the language may look different and sound different in different contexts that we work, some of our thinking behind this.
Wow, this is really exciting. Is this from the book?
No, this will not be in the book, but we're working on how do we, we are working how we make this available to a wider audience, yes.
Wow, this is really fascinating. So I see just how creative, you know, putting this model together, it has some of the IDEO language and process in it, but that you've also just really said, God's at work in this process.
Yes.
for it to be Christian innovation. And in another slide you had, you know, that the FTE, you had some theological principles there. You know, it has to speak to the least among us. Christian innovation is, it focuses on the least among us, about creating new solutions to problems, experimentation in the margins, new and alternative to what is or has been, enhanced by diversity and collaboration, ancient, ancestral, iterative, and evolving.
Yes.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're still kind of working through this, but, I mean, there is, like, some method to our madness. Like, we have a whole framework that I'm trying to work through, which is this idea that, you know, it centers the margins. Jesus says, suffer not the little children, but bring them to me. Like, these children were in the margin of the community. He says, bring them closer to me. It is about a type of liberatory authorship. Mm-hmm. That we can be co-authors in our own liberation. It is autobiographical in the sense that the margins are resources. Blessed are the poor. There is an ancestral legacy and a gift in this type of autobiographical worldview. Then you have the kind of democratized praxis. Some of this is, you know, Paulo Freire and others, but it's about the disinherited, as Thurman talks about Jesus and the disinherited. The disinherited can innovate. They've been innovating. When you think about disinherited communities who've always been working in the shadows of our empire, modern and ancient, that praxis focus on the structures to be transformed or alternatives, and that working and acting with versus working for others or on behalf of others, which is really a pushback against the missionary stance that has happened in so many places around the world where white missionaries have come trying to do good or whatever, but really have been colonizing or making other folks into their own image. And then this idea that teaching and learning innovation is a political act. What Jesus was talking about was this idea that disciples of the way are participating in God's work of shaping the well-being of community. And then his ancestral way of knowing, the stories that we tell ourselves. Our gospel stories are not just static stories, but they're stories that we tell ourselves over and over again. They're intuitive practices. There's an interplay between the mind and the emotion and the spirit and the senses between the body and the natural world. And then this whole idea is that prayer and fasting, all these things are representative of a kind of a sacred technology that helps ground ourselves, that helps slow us down, that helps us become more present to spirit and God who works in the everyday and mundane of life. And then this idea that we are engaged in the production as primary activity of humanity, that we are called to you know, into this work of production, and we're creators of good and so on and so on. So these are just some of the when we think about a Christian framework, a transformed world requires a kind of autobiographical worldview, a democratized praxis, ancestral ways of knowing, and this idea that we can be creators of alternatives.
Okay, so tell us about a time when the FTE, when you tried and failed something, when you went through that, the screen where you had the five steps, you know, you kind of had to imagine and you had to ideate, you had to come up with something, then you had to try to test something and find out, you know, like, tell us, how did you do something that maybe it didn't work as well, or you learned something from it? Because innovation has all these stops and starts, right?
They do. They have a lot of stops and starts. And sometimes we can only see its impact retrospectively in hindsight. In a vapid society where everybody's looking for everything in the short term, sometimes we need to stay with things a little bit longer to actually see its real impact. But just a prime example, you know, when I became president, we had to cut our budget by a third. And there was no way to continue doing the work that we were doing, being on the hamster wheel of our production, and also getting a handle on, all right, so how are we going to address working through a new or a smaller kind of financial footprint? And so we had to get curious about this problem, which is, you know, how do we actually kind of address this financial challenge, but also how do we be responsive to a new changing landscape with these millennials now bursting onto the scenes in comparison to the Gen Xers like myself? who have kind of come and gone. And now today we have post-millennials who are starting college. So what does that mean for all of our programs? So we got off the hamster wheel and we started, you know, getting curious and listening to different pockets around the country about what were the leadership challenges that people were facing, what kind of leadership is needed now in respect to those challenges, what are the capacities do those leaders need, and what resources are needed now to do this work well. And we've heard all kinds of stuff. And what it all suggested is that we had done really great programs and they had been good, but what they didn't attend to was an increasing diverse landscape, the ways in which people were entering or exploring ministry, not in seminary, but pre-seminary. And we had to recognize that there were different pathways in which different communities of people were exploring ministry. And to create, to be primarily a fellowship program that was pretty much locked to the traditional kind of mainline kind of normative way of education. You go to college, you go to grad school, and then you get ordained and you get a job. We're missing a whole host of folks in terms of their exploration of ministry. So then we began, you know, we started having to make some meaning of that and say, okay, so what can we do differently? So we began ideating with our funder partners, began ideating with our staff. We brought some people in to kind of test some of our ideation, and then we began experimenting, which was we wrote into new grants, and we began almost like kind of like a startup organization. We was kind of building the ship as we go on, new policies and processes and eligibility requirements for this and that and so on and so on. And we've been doing that for 5 or 6 years now, really trying it and validating and proving that this is a worthy direction to go, where 8 years ago, you couldn't access any of our events unless you got a fellowship. And now 8 years later, you can access our vocational professional development opportunities and not be tied to a fellowship. And you can leverage partners, institutional partners that can nominate young people to come into these programs. And the diversity of people that we have, the diversity of partners that we have, are much more porous and a multiplicity within those partners than what we had, you know, 8 to 10 years ago. Now, we bumped our heads several times. We had a lot of false starts. We had a lot of times like, man, it's just easy to go back and do what we used to do because now we've made our jobs a whole lot more complex and difficult and challenging. Is this the right thing that we should have done? And we kept staying with it, looking for the little small wins that were kind of the breadcrumbs of saying, yeah, keep on working at it. It's gonna unfold. And I think, you know, we've done a good job. Now, we were also at that time trying to get away from the ways in which the organization and the staff was siloed. But in the process, we created new kind of silos. And so now we're in a whole nother organizational process where we're taking 6 months off. We got an organizational consultant who's trying to work through us through another assessment, a 360, kind of a 360 evaluation of the organization. And we got a new strategic direction that helps us deepen into our work with the partners that will help carry this work forward. It's a constant learning process. And what we've learned is that we've got some things right and we got some things awfully wrong. But we've learned from those things and hopefully we'll create better solutions than we've done in the past.
You didn't tell me about the book.
The book. So here's the thing about the book, right? And book titles. So, you know, there's marketing and all this type of stuff. And, you know, what we kind of realize is that we, now the book title has emerged and now it's going to be called Another Way.
Oh, okay.
Another Way. And
it's called Another Way. And is there a subtitle?
The subtitle is kind of Living and Leading Change.
Okay.
For Good by Design. Or it's Living and Leading Change for Goodness Sake. Kind of a snarky kind of, and you know, you got your publishers that are like, they've been working back and forth talking about what makes it more marketable. So, you know, anyway.
Don't even get me started. Yeah.
The biggest thing is this, right? Which is, we in our organization have been saying time and time, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be an alternative to the ways in which we work. There has to be an alternative to the ways in which we do our work. And there has to be a better way that allows us to be whole people and not work like machines, and to allow us the type of space and time to reflect and to lead profound change, that a calling calls within ourselves, within our organizations and our communities, and then catalyzes us to participate in what God is calling us to do in the world. And to do that, what we realize is that change is not merely a game of trade-offs in which we sacrifice personal and communal well-beings for the pursuit of shared ideas. It's believing that a better world is possible, you know, and we don't have to resign ourselves, you know, the kind of reproducing social realities that we say we don't want. So this, another way, is really kind of articulating a process that we call a care approach. And it's about how one creates space in a community, ask self-awakening questions within a community, reflect together critically and theologically, and then enact our next most faithful steps towards the ways in which we're being called to live and to lead the kind of change that we want to bring about in service to a transformed world and a new heaven and a new earth. So, you know, part of what we are then doing is recognizing that, you know, institutions and organizations can learn to respond courageously to increasingly complex challenges that are facing their communities and the field of theological education. Young people growing up in these communities can find ways to make a difference in their lives. And organizations can find ways to reimagine their role and cultivate a new kind of leader that we need now. So we believe that there's a better way. We've seen it. We've experienced it. And it never ceases to amaze us. And we think that our care effect or our care process that we've been kind of codifying the ways in which people do this innovatively is a way of doing this. So I would say, if you ask me, well, who's this book for? Who's the audience? I would say that, you know, the audience would be individuals who aspire to discover a life of meaning and purpose, who want to figure it out for the first time or once again. It's also a book for a guide or a facilitator who, by their role in nature, helps others discover meaning and purpose. And it's also for leaders of an organization who wrestle with how to create lasting positive change in their context. And I would say, ultimately, you know, this book is for people who ask the question, so how do I lead in pursuit of what I'm for rather than getting stuck in what I'm against? How can I learn to lead in life-giving ways? When I get greater clarity about myself and my call, how do I take steps to move in that direction? How do I mobilize my organization to be present in the world differently? And how do I adapt faithfully to the complex shifts in our environments? And how do I keep on leading change without burning out? So this is who the book is for, these three different audiences that are asking these kinds of questions.
That's really exciting. It sounds like it's a book about discernment and innovation as a verb.
Yes.
Okay. You know that our initiative called The Lives of Meaning and Purpose is to help people in congregations engage the meaning of vocation in their lives.
Yes.
So what do you think? You've already said this a little bit, but what do you think is the connection between vocation and innovation?
Vocation and innovation. Well, I would say this is that, you know, in the end, vocation is the long arc of the life of an organization or people or an individual. And it moves towards the telos, which is one's purpose in life. And in the rearview mirror, in hindsight, what we can see are the episodic moments in our lives which are callings. Callings are the breadcrumbs that leads us on this type of vocational arc towards our purpose. And we talk a little bit about that in the book, but I think, you know, you can't get to leadership without dealing with issues of identity and context and communities and how you were shaped as an individual, your politics and the other kind of market as well as social forces and familial forces that have shaped you as an individual around your identity and your gifts and your deep longings and your questions. You can't become a leader without dealing with these questions around vocation. And if a leader is going to lead, a leader has to lead in the midst of uncertainty. Otherwise, you don't need a leader. You just need a manager, because a manager already knows where it's going. They just needs to manage from point A to point B. But a leader has to be a leader has to be able to lead in midst of uncertainty, in the mystery of life, in awe. And it takes a community of people who are engaged in leadership. And oftentimes, leadership and leading requires profound change within ourselves. Innovation is a novel process, a novel discernment process that allows people to bring about change by coming up with novel solutions that ordinary people can do extraordinary things to meet the problems that they face in order to create the kind of transformed world that we all long for. So to me, I think those two things go hand in hand, that vocation and innovation are necessarily part of the DNA of a community and individuals and the leadership practice of a group to shape its, to co-create and co-shape its future.
Okay, we're just about at an hour, so I'll just give you a chance. Is there anything else you'd like to add? And then I just had this little, that last question about, were there any resources that you'd suggest to our grantees that have helped you in terms of understanding innovation? Anything you heard yourself say? I know somebody who does interviews who likes to ask, what'd you hear yourself say today?
Well, I would just say this, is that I think there's some aspect of the world that mourns and is deeply grieved if we do not find the courage to take faithful steps towards the ways in which we're called to bring our gifts into the world and to help heal it and help shape a better future. If not for ourselves, for our children, our children's children. And I think, you know, innovation is a Christian innovation is an important practice of Christian communities to be engaged in that work. And I think the more that we do it, the fewer people will be sitting in their pews or wherever they're standing, wondering about, man, why am I here? What are my gifts? And how can I help create a more hopeful future? With the late poet, you know, Mary Oliver said, well, you know, what are you going to do if you have one wild, precious life? And then I would say, once you know what you're going to do it, what is the process by which you're actually going to help harness that forward in service to the vocation that you're called to live and to bring about in the world? And to me, I just think that, you know, the innovation can be, at least Christian innovation can be, one of those meaningful practices that can really help move us in the right direction.